Hello, and welcome to another episode of Dice Exploder. Each week, we take a tabletop RPG mechanic, stick it on a fishing line, and see what we can catch. My name is Sam Dunnewald, and my co-host this week is David Block. David's not like a guy out there in the community. He's a guy from one of my weekly games. He's smart as hell, and we go all the way back to middle school. And like, I have been enjoying using this podcast to put a spotlight on people I think deserve to be heard more, but sometimes I just have a topic that I must talk about, and I seek out the person I most want to talk about it with. Such was the case with the game We Are But Worms, a one-word RPG by Riverhouse Games. I think this game is, unironically, the best RPG ever made. It is such a galaxy brain. What is a game? What can a game be? Is a joke a game? Why do we care about definitions in the first place? We Are But Worms looks at those questions, ascends to a higher brain exploding level, gazes down upon them, and says, LOL. It is the highest of art and the lowest of brows. It is beauty distilled. It is the greatest work of minimalism I have ever seen. And I believe David agrees with me. In fact, the only game he's ever published is a hack of it, a supplement, rather. But no more. A one-letter supplement for We Are But Worms, a one-word RPG. So I asked him on the show. But as we were planning, I realized we weren't going to be able to stop with We Are But Worms. If we were going to engage with all those questions I just rattled off, we were going to have to cover the Lyric Games movement at large. And also the very concept of art and whether it can be good or bad. And I believe the result is among the best episodes of this show yet. So heads up that we will be spoiling the word very early on in our discussion. If you're tickled by the idea of a one-word RPG and have not read this one yet, I highly recommend going out and checking it out on its own terms. It's free, you can just Google it. And then come back and listen. Okay, buckle up. Here is David Block with the complete game text of We Are But Worms, a one-word RPG. David, thanks for being here.
Hello, yes, happy to be here.
What are we talking about on this beautiful morning?
Today, we are talking about We Are But Worms, a one-word RPG. And before we get to the word, I gotta paint a little bit of a mind picture here, because that's what we do in RPGs.
Yeah. Yes.
So the cover of this book is, it's text on an image. The image is a kind of a close-up of those like two-tone gummy worms, like they're like red and green and blue and red, just like a sea of those. And on top of it are big chunky white letters with a little bit of a drop shadow that says, We Are But Worms, a one-word RPG. And then the next page, much smaller text directly in the center, it says, Writhe. And that's it. That's the whole game. It does everything it sets out to. It's evocative and clean and indicative of the form of a lyric game.
Yeah, which is our real topic today. So I unironically think this is the greatest RPG ever made. I'm just in love with this thing. If you've been listening to this show for a while, you probably know by this point that I'm like obsessed with minimalism. And I like that sort of very small, very clean, like polished to a sheen kind of mechanic. And this game, like, you can't do it more than this. Like, you get down to a single word. And, you know, I in a lot of ways don't care whether anyone goes and plays this game, although you certainly could. Like,
yeah, I would say, but we gave you everything you need to play this game right now. You keep your headphones on and just writhe a little bit.
But the aesthetics of it are just so perfect and beautiful. It's so provocative. We're going to get into all of that. But I wanted to hear you also talk about what in particular it is that you like so much about this game.
I mean, like, it might be a little bit silly to say about a one-word RPG, but word choice. It's like, if you pick just the right word, you only need the one.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if I would say it's the best RPG ever made, because people make a lot of RPGs. Some people might be toiling away in obscurity that have also great, great words. But I think this one is just like charming and a little bit shitposty and like a little bit, you know, existential despair And
I did feel for a minute there, like the cops might burst in the door and arrest me for us taking this long to get to the word shitpost in our conversation here. Because it's clearly also that. It's a meme. It's a shitpost. But one of the things that makes it beautiful to me and also such a good shitpost is the fact that it is, on top of that, a playable RPG and a statement about game design and a cute little gummy worm package, you know?
Yeah, it just does. Like I said, I'm a big fan of things that can do sort of exactly what they set out to do in like a very kind of clean, effective fashion. And I think this is a really good example of that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really good.
Yeah. And you mentioned before, like our kind of actual topic, like not that we couldn't get a solid, you know, 45 minutes out of talking about Rive, but it's just kind of lyric games in general.
Yeah. So let's put this game in the context of lyric games at large. We should start probably with what are lyric games? So I pulled a lot of this from a couple of articles by Linda Codega. They wrote one both on Medium a while ago, and now they write for Dicebreaker and have written really interesting pieces in both of those places. But lyric games, I think, are described often as sort of being like game poems. They're really small and like lyrical, like the comparison to lyric poetry is where the term came from originally. And Linda Codega has sort of three indicators for what makes something a lyric game.
The first of which is a removal of distance between the quote unquote player and the character. Like in a lyric game, like it's less about playing a character and more about kind of seeing the world in a different way for the span of the game in a way that other RPGs don't quite hit.
Yeah. So like, I really love this lyric game called My Brain is a Stick of Butter, which is about trying to convey to the player what it is like to live with ADHD. And it's essentially a bunch of rules that have you writing tasks on a whiteboard and then rolling dice and spinning a spinner and flipping coins to determine which of the tasks you're going to do next. And then sometimes you erase stuff from the whiteboard and you're moving all over the place. And it's this complicated, overwhelming set of strictures on how your brain should be working to move you from task to task that are I don't have ADHD, but I think convey the feeling of it quite well, is my understanding. And in it, you know, you're playing as yourself, or, you know, maybe a version of yourself that has ADHD. And so unlike in Dungeons and Dragons, you're not creating like a hobbit avatar or a big wizard to go do a fantasy with. You are taking a set of rules and imagining your own experience inside of those sets of rules.
Yeah, exactly. There's no playbook that is, there's one playbook in the game, and the playbook is a person with ADHD.
Yeah.
And one kind of like key thing about the game is like the tasks that you're switching between are not like, there's not really like a difficulty associated to the tasks. The complication comes in the sort of constant switching and remembering them and sort of trying to maintain context on all these tasks and balancing around in ways that you just sort of can't handle. Like the metaphor that the game uses is that your brain is a stick of butter sliding from task to task that you cannot control.
It's a good metaphor.
Yeah. Like I also don't have ADHD, but I do have like occasional executive dysfunction. And I read this game and I was like, oh, I can see exactly how some of this would go, especially in the sense of like, I need to sort of remember the things that I'm supposed to be doing, even though I just can't do them right now for whatever reason.
Yeah.
But like for whatever mysterious made up brain reason.
Brain is chemistry. Happening. It's weird.
Yeah.
And that's like what the game's about. Yeah. It's a cool game in that way. It is both a rule book and it's something that you could play, but maybe you wouldn't actually play it. Maybe just reading it and thinking about it is the intended experience, even if it is a functional object also. And that's another thing that's not even in Linda Codega's, you know, three signposts of lyric games. But that is something that comes up a lot when you talk with people about lyric games, is the idea that reading is a form of play. And the way I've always imagined interpreting that is you don't have to play My Brain is a Stick of Butter to get a ton of the content out of it, to get the intended purpose of it. Just sort of reading and imagining the thing that it is trying to do is sufficient, if not the entire intended experience.
Yeah, like you said, you could play it, but if you do play it, you might not get much more out of the experience other than like, yeah, that is kind of what I signed up for. This makes it seem like it's really difficult to, you know, do this kind of task and context switching all the time. And maybe you walk away from it with a new understanding of some of the difficulties of living with ADHD. And that's great. But you could also do that simply by reading the book too.
Yeah.
And it also, I think, touches nicely on Linda's next point, which is the gamification of everyday experiences.
Yeah, it just does it perfectly. Honestly, we've kind of already talked about the manner in which it does that. Like, it's gamifying doing your chores.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it is not, like, fantastical. Lyric games are often grounded in reality in a way that seems like it might be strange for poetry, but it's similar to, you know, poetry and things like that. They're based on, like, here is the world around me, here is how I see it, how I understand it, and I'm going to present it to you in the form of a game or something that some people would describe as kind of game adjacent, at least.
Yeah. So another example that I like in the gamification of everyday experiences kind of thing. So I haven't actually read this game. I've only read Linda's description of it in their article. But the game is Until Next Time by Legendary Vermin, which is a game about smoking, in which you get together with some other smokers, you buy a pack of cigarettes, and then you take turns smoking the cigarettes and answering some of the questions from the game that are like, what is the worst weather you've ever smoked in? Or what's the weirdest place you've ever smoked? Just stuff like that, talking about your smoking history. And then when you're done with the final cigarette, everyone says, until next time, and exchanges phone numbers, and then they leave. And the next time anyone smokes, they have to text everyone, we lost. And that's the entire game. I love, it's just another beautiful little poem. Like, is anyone going to play this game? I bet this game has been played. Yeah. But also, it's so provocative just by reading of it. Like, you get so much out of just thinking about the questions as you read them, imagining yourself there with other people, like talking about your history of smoking, and then feeling that weight of someone losing and texting all of you, and the pathos that comes with that. And all of that is out of putting game on top of an everyday experience, smoking, and, you know, failing to quit smoking. The last of Linda's indicators here is the reversal of assumptions to impact play, which I think is pretty vague. Defining lyric games is pretty hard. I was already thinking about the, like, I know it when I see it porno quote, but then Linda also uses that in one of their pieces, right?
Yeah.
And the reversal of assumptions to impact play feels the most sort of like, okay, whatever. Like, probably.
That one's like less about like, here's sort of the mechanics or whatever, and more like, here's kind of the vibe. Like, this is like going to be at least a little contrarian, a little like looking to surprise and maybe delight and maybe just make you think a little bit about people or the world.
Yeah. So the last thing I want to say about lyric games as we've kind of set them up here is that we were talking about these before we started recording, and you said this great thing about how one of the things about lyric games is if anyone did try to define them, someone inside the movement would come and prove that taxonomy wrong, would like push against that and find something else to make that's a lyric game that does not fit in those bounds. And I think a lot of lyric games, as we kind of said earlier, like, are only hitting some of these things. Another one that I love here is Collectible Trading Moon Game, which is this this game where essentially it's like whenever you see a moon, you have to collect that moon by writing it down, write a poem about it, do something with it to collect it. And then when you encounter other people with moon collections, you can moon duel them. And there are all these rules for like playing moons against each other and doing battle. But it's this loving parody of Magic the Gathering or collectible card games, while also being this weird, strange, absurdist version of a game like that.
Yeah, like it has little like lines and bits that are kind of like Blazeball or Welcome to Night Vale style. Yeah. Like, hey, there's like potentially some dreadful happenings also going on, but
yeah,
you don't need to worry about it too much. Nothing is wildly defined. It is operating on vibes to some extent. Yeah.
So this game I bring up because technically there's removal of the distance between the player and the character here, because it's more like a pastiche of a board game than it is of a role-playing game. But it is also, is it the gamification of everyday experiences? Sort of. You're gaming the experience of looking at the moon or talking to people about memories, I guess. But that's not the primary thing.
Yeah, I mean, to bring up like the sort of reversal of assumptions or like flipping things on its head, it's more about the everydayification of a game experience.
Like the game experience
of like sitting down and playing Magic with someone is a very specific and vivid thing to a lot of people, like both of us included. And this is sort of saying like, hey, that collection of cards that you've spent money and time acquiring, what if that was memories of like the moon on a clear night?
Yeah.
Is that not just as precious and just as important as, you know, your Tarmogoyf or whatever?
Well, and the other thing that I love about this game is how level one is what you just described, but level two is each one of your cards in Magic the Gathering collections is like that too. Like you remember opening your holographic Charizard, right? Like
I still have a playset of Priest of Titania that I have had since I was in fourth grade.
Yeah. Like, I got my goblins deck in there, my goblin lackeys, baby. Like, yeah.
Yeah, those are equally precious. Like, I could sit down and play a bunch of elves and tell someone a story like, oh, like, I won a game with this, or I figured out I could cast this card on turn three, and that was revelatory for the, like, 10-year-old me. So
this is an overview of what the two of us think about Lyric games, I think. There very much is this vibe of you know it when you see it.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
And I want to pause also and talk then a little bit more about the sort of history of Lyric games and like where they were coming from and when they were happening. So Lyric games started being made, I think really in the early 2010s, where the first like game poems were starting to come out. Mm-hmm. But the Lyric game movement specifically, which I would describe as coming out of the story game world and being particularly queer and particularly anti-cap, was maybe like 2018, 2017, and then certainly in 2019 when John R. Harness coined the term lyric games based on lyric poetry in a Twitter thread. And I think there's been a little bit less activity in the lyric game movement as of late, but I still see the occasional lyric game that comes out. I don't think this movement really has gone away, even if the flurry of activity around it was sort of 2018, 2019, 2020.
I think it's also very reasonable to assume and see how lyric games can also like turn back around and influence games that are coming out in terms of games that are especially focused on like vignettes or small series of of scenes.
Yeah, I actually have some thoughts on examples there.
Yeah.
I think another aspect of lyric games has been a big emphasis on the layout. Like often people were making like really kind of just like throw it up there, like messy. I made this in MS Paint or Affinity or whatever in like 20 minutes kind of design and throwing that into the wind. And that brought this sort of graffiti down to earth. I'm just throwing this poem out there kind of vibe to everything. That like that kind of graphic design, I really think influenced games like Morkborg and everything that has come after that, like this messy graphic design that is really conveying a mood. Lyric games seem to be so much about mood. And on a text level, one of my favorite publications of the past couple of years is this thing called Volume 2 Monsters Ampersand, which is essentially a monster manual with very, very minimal stats and beautiful tiny poems instead of monster descriptions. And each one feels like the OSR equivalent of a lyric game. Like, here's a small bite of content that you could definitely use at your table in your fantasy campaign, presented in like two sentences. So let me give an example here.
Yeah, I was going to say, I have not read this, but this sounds really cool because it is about kind of creating and setting like a tone in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And so like the thing that you're adapting out of this monster manual isn't the specific stats of the monster. It is, hey, here's the vibe.
Yes.
And we're going to trust you to know whatever system you're putting this monster in to be able to create the vibe within that system.
Yeah.
But here's the vibe. Here's the tone poem.
So here we go. We got bandits, HD1, AC as armor, damage as weapon, 1d6 relatives to grieve, close enough to know who did it. That's it. That's the thing.
Yeah.
Like, that's a lyric game right there, right? Like, this whole thing is, it's an OSR supplement, but I don't know how you get to this without the lyric game movement.
Yeah, definitely.
And on the other side of things, I think people have been pushing back further in history too, to see where other people have been making this kind of art for a long time. Like, I saw this incredible Twitter thread a couple of weeks ago about Yoko Ono's Grapefruit, which is this art installation with essentially a bunch of lyric games written on index cards and next to art in like a place where people can go read them in a gallery. You gotta like look at these fucking things. Like, you want to read Snow Piece.
Think that snow is falling. Think that snow is falling everywhere, all the time. When you talk with a person, think that snow is falling between you and on the person. Stop conversing when you think the person is covered by snow. That's Yoko Ono, and that was written or published in 1963. So this is not this is not like a new thing, this sort of tone poem inviting you to imagine a specific thing and maybe behave in a way based on that, but also maybe not. Maybe just think about it and that's fine.
Yeah. So with lyric games fully and comprehensively introduced, I'm sure we didn't leave anything out and we perfectly circumscribed this entire movement. Do you think these things are games? Are these games?
I mean, I feel like the question you want me to ask is, well, what is a game?
No, what I want you to say is, yes, obviously, why are you being gatekeepy? Like, thing that I think comes up in conversation a lot here is like what is a game? And as you're saying, and are these games? And on the one hand, I just, before we engage with that question, because I do think it's fun to engage with that question, to crawl up the ass of philosophy 101 students and like try to do that thing, I also just think it's stupid. It's like not a good question. It's like, they're cool. I don't care. Like, why does it matter if they're games? Why can't we just love and appreciate these things? So often when people ask that question, is this really a game? They're trying to find a way to look down on it. And I want to engage with that question. But first, I want to say, these things rock. We love them. Like,
like 100%. I was going to say, as far as like, is this even a game, is a question that matters. It does matter, because people have that preconception of like, oh, is this art? Is this a game? Like, how am I supposed to think about this in terms of, is this worthy of my time and attention?
Yeah.
Like, when you're asking, is this a game? You're asking, is this worthy of my time and attention?
And do I need to care about this?
Yeah, because the people who are asking if is this a game, they don't have a comprehensive, clear taxonomy on what they consider a game and not a game. Yeah. They have just sort of vibes like, eh, games kind of do this, or games kind of are like this.
Yeah.
And lyric games are built to say, well, no, games are other things also.
Yeah. I love the comparison here to provocative form pushing art in other mediums. Like, is Fountain, the famous urinal, like displayed in a museum as a piece of art, like, is Fountain high art? Or is it money laundering? Like, or is it both?
Or is it, to bring it back around a little bit, is it a shit post?
Is it a shit post? Yeah, it's probably all three of those things. And I think Fountain is an incredibly successful piece of art because it is so provocative and makes people so mad in that way. And you know, bring it to music, like 4:33 by John Cage, this famous song that is 4 minutes and 33 seconds of quote unquote silence. Like, is that a song? It made a lot of people really mad. Like, it was this very provocative piece of art that is encouraging you to listen to the room you are experiencing it in, to hear the sounds of the concert hall and the still piano, and to consider the act of performance and the idea of performance and the bounds of it. And I think a lot of lyric games are operating at that same level, like with that same level of beauty and intelligence and form pushingness that 4:33 and Fountain have.
Yeah.
That's what We Are But Worms is to me.
Yeah, to kind of put a bit of a point on the 4:33 thing, my partner and I went to a chamber orchestra performance last night. And while we were there, like someone, you know, a couple rows back and a little ways over, like got a tickle in their throat and they were coughing for a little bit. And I was like, yep, this is a concert. This is what it means to go to a classical music concert. You have you have someone coughing a few rows back. And yeah, it's like, you know, quote unquote disruptive, but it's also just that's a part of it. That's a part of being in a shared space with people in that way.
And it's beautiful when a piece like 4:33, just by its very existence, even without being performed, can like bring perspective to you and your experience watching a chamber orchestra playing other things.
Yeah, because like that's really sort of what it's saying. Is like it's making you think about specifically like not the music, the absence of the music in sort of the concert going music experience. And that's, I think, is really cool.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if I'd be super gung-ho about spending money and buying tickets to go see a performance of it.
Well, listen, I would hope it's not the only song that was played, but...
Yeah, I would say it was also like Beethoven and stuff, which there was Beethoven last night. But yeah, the moment that I heard the coughing and thought like, oh yeah, this is it. This is classical music. And like you can listen to it on, you know, NPR or whatever, but there's something special about... Kind of like going to a movie in a theater.
Yeah, totally.
There's enough stuff that happens around it, like not just the ritual, but the idea that you're in this with other people, you're in it together. And to be reminded of that, even if it's quote unquote like detracting from the performance, is worth considering that that is special and that's an important part of it.
There's magic to it. So speaking of magic, let's take this question seriously of what is a game and are lyric games games? And to do that, speaking of magic, I want to talk about Mark Rosewater's take on this. So Mark Rosewater has been the lead designer of Magic the Gathering for a long time now. I think if you are interested in game design, and if you're here at this podcast, you probably are, his writing and podcasts are really, really useful, even if you are not familiar with Magic. So I recommend seeking those out. Maybe we'll have some recommendations in the show notes or something where to get started. But he wrote an article on June 4th, 2018 called What is a Game? In which he lays out his taxonomy and definition. So Mark's definition of a game is a game is a thing with a goal, restrictions, agency, and a lack of real world relevance. And he also walks through definitions for what happens if you're missing any one of those things. So if you're missing a goal, then he says... That's a toy. So like Lego or Minecraft have those other three things, but not a goal. If you're missing restrictions, then that's like an activity, like jogging or hiking. If you're missing agency, that's an event, like, you know, your concert, David, or like going to the movies or whatever. And if you're missing a lack of real world relevance, then that's just living your life, which is full of goals and restrictions and agency. And the thing I love about this definition is that it's not judgmental, right? Like, he loves Legos. He loves jogging and going to the movies, but he's defining them as distinct from games. He's really just focusing on breaking down the vocabulary here so we can have better conversations about all these things. So I really like this definition. I think this is a really good definition, and I think lyric games fuck around with this definition still, right? Like, lyric games... are intentionally pushing at that boundary of real world relevance all the time in a way, ways we've already discussed. They're pushing at agency a lot of the time. Like in My Brain is a Stick of Butter, your agency is being extremely reduced. There are ways in which you are not being allowed to act in the way that you want. I mean, we're talking about restrictions right now too. And then goals, like most of these Lyric games do have goals, like Collectible Trading Moon game has this goal of like, you know, winning a duel against your partners in playing the game. But it is a goal that is not really accomplishable because you can't, what are we doing? Like, you can't like go out there and duel someone with your moons and win. What does that mean? And I it's so wonderful how Lyric games are in conversation with the definition of what is a game. They are intentionally being provocative in this way of what are we doing here when we play?
Yeah, and that's, you know, to bring it back to We Are But Worms, I think that, like, if ever a game is asking the question of what are we doing here, it's that one.
We're writhing, baby.
Yeah, like, I don't think when you play a game, you're really that far removed from writhe.
Like, yeah, yeah.
Like, I've played games of Magic where writhe was basically my only option. I've played RPGs where it's like, we played games where the whole table stops for a few minutes and someone makes a difficult decision.
Yeah.
And what I'm doing in that time, like I'm laughing along and I'm writhing. I'm there. But yeah, it's I do think, like you said, Mark's definition is very good. It's fairly comprehensive, but it's also not perfect. I also don't think there's value in having a perfect definition.
Well, yeah. And the value of, because no definition is ever going to be perfect.
Yeah, like, exactly.
The value
exactly.
of having a conversation about definitions is to have the kind of conversation we're having right now to talk about this stuff and push at the edges of art and push at the borders of our brains. And like, that's what good art is about. And I think that's what good conversation around good art is about.
Yeah, 100%. There is one quote by some game designer who I forget, and I maybe look the name up in a minute, but it is, the goal of a game is to win, but it's not the winning that's important. It's the goal.
Mm.
And like in a conversation like this, like, you know, the goal might be to sort of come up with a definition for what is a game, what is play, like how do we value these things? But making the perfect definition is a fool's errand. Like,
yeah.
The perfect taxonomy is not really feasible. I pull from a lot of like scientific names for bugs and cactuses and whatever else when I'm like trying to name RPG characters.
Uh-huh.
And if there's one thing that I've learned from like diving into Wikipedia and clicking around on like bug taxonomies, it's just scientists are doing their best, but it's hard. It's not.
Yeah.
Being able to say like, yes, this insect is definitely a part of this family because of blah blah blah, it's like we're pretty sure, but also like there's a lot of bugs out there and there's a lot of weird bugs out there. So we're just doing our best. And like if scientists are just doing their best with all the bugs trying to do something like what is art, forget about it. Like good luck.
Putting things into categories can be useful. I mean, the idea that we can have a conversation about Lyric games at large is cool, and also it's a fool's errand to put things in the categories. Like things are just different.
Yeah.
That's how it works.
Yeah, exactly. Like once scientists have figured out bugs, then we can maybe work on art. Yeah.
Sanguis populi, the blood of the people, the dark protectors of the hidden city of Azeroth, deep within the illusory forest. Familiar with death as they have eluded it, they are called upon for a desperate task. Slaying a creature from the great beyond. Blythe.
This might not be easy. Being surrounded by death. I don't understand how they can do it.
Elvira.
Someone must watch the bodies, and none do so as diligently.
Swan.
Into action so fast. I love when we get to go out.
It came from the sky. This great pale monstrosity.
You just had to sate your hunger. You couldn't have saved it for the beasts.
I prefer the gratuity.
Vampirism is not immortality. It only prolongs the inevitable. Is this the end for Sanguis Populi? Blood in the snow, a tale yet told. Halloween 2025.
Sorceress, lower the barrier for just a moment. Sanguis Populi departs.
Listen to Tale as Yet Told wherever you get your podcasts.
So, okay, while we're on the subject of defining, like, what is a game, I want to talk about, like, what is play also, because we mentioned this a little bit earlier, but a refrain that comes up in conversations around lyric games a lot is this idea that reading is an act of play, that doing that imagining of how the game might go is itself an act of playing the game, or if not playing the game, then, like, play in some sort of abstract notion of what play is. Does that feel right to you?
Oh, like 100%. Like, I've spent an order of magnitude, maybe several orders of magnitude more time thinking about playing Magic or playing RPGs than actually playing them.
Yeah.
And time spent building a character ahead of time, time spent thinking about that, you know, ahead of like a session zero. Like, how could that not be equally valuable play? Like,
yeah,
if you sit down and you do some world building, you come up with some cool factions, you come up with some, like, whatever you want, whatever you need for your RPG, for your game, that's play. I couldn't even imagine what else it would be, really.
Yeah, if it's not play, like, I think this is one of those places where you could come in and you could make an argument that strictly defines play as something that happens at the table, and okay, cool, who cares? Like, that, it's another one of those things where there's clearly so much value in the making of the character, like you're saying. And I like the way lyric games push at the idea of how broad is play as an idea? Like, is designing games play? I think so. A lot of the time, yeah. I mean, like, prepping as a GM feels like play in the same way you're describing, like, prepping a character before session zero. And prepping as a GM is often essentially design work.
Yeah, and definitely.
Is criticism play? Like, is taking these lyric games where imagining them and engaging with the text feels like play, and then talking about them on this podcast, like, are we playing a game right now? Have we played several games here? Like, maybe. Sort of.
Yeah.
Who cares? Like, we've engaged with the game on the game's terms in a fun and interesting way. I love the way the lyric game movement at large underlines the value in doing all those things.
Yeah, definitely. And, like, it's interesting to me because there are, like, some games that I've read where I just, there are certain circumstances in my life that I'm just going to think about those games forever in.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the next time I look up and see the moon on a clear night, I'm going to think about the collectible trading moon game, because it's in my brain now. It's going to be there forever.
I collected a moon the other night. I did it. I could sing the song for you right now of the moon that I saw that was weird and red and low to the horizon right after I walked out of the new Spider-Verse movie, fucking amped out of my mind.
Yeah, like, that's great. Like, I, you know, on the drive home from the concert the other night, I didn't see the moon. And that's okay. Maybe I'll get the next one.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it's cool the way that these games gamify everyday experiences. Aside, I'm not a big fan of the word gamify, but in this specific instance, I think it's okay, because we're making the argument that these are games, and my everyday experiences, at least a subset of them, is now being filtered through the lens of these games.
Mm-hmm.
We touched on, until next time, the smoking game. I don't smoke, but I have friends who smoke. I've worked in restaurants. I've been around enough smokers to see the truth of that game. And that if I ever hear someone say, can I bum a cigarette? I'm going to think of that game.
Yeah.
And the questions it asks and the way that it creates the sort of empathy for the experience of a smoker, even for me, like someone who doesn't.
Yeah, absolutely.
We made the comparison to poetry earlier, and it is like a good lyric game will kind of stick with you in that same way that reading a poem can, where it's like, oh, I read this poem and something about it just hit for me.
Yeah.
And I'm going to remember, maybe not the whole thing, but at least like particular lines that will just they're just going to be with me forever now.
Or sometimes not even the thing itself. Like, you'll just remember the feeling of the thing.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. That's, we talked about the commonality among lyric games of like having strong vibes and having a strong mood.
Mm-hmm.
And there are games where you read it and you experience the mood and you think, that's a good mood. That's an interesting mood. And then it might happen again to you 6 months later and you're like, oh yeah, this reminds me of that game that I read, that poem that I read. I don't know. It's, they're just cool. They're cool.
Yeah. Why do you hate the term gamify?
So I don't like the term gamify because it has been slightly co-opted by, I don't know if it's co-opted or originates from a sort of putting a bright face on occasionally like negative or very capitalistic things. Maybe it was my initial exposure to gamify as a word was very much around what Amazon tries to do at like their warehouse and with their employees there, where they create this like kind of fun pastiche of, oh, hey, if you take this much stuff from shelves, it translates to some amount of meaningless points that does not improve your quality of life, but maybe makes your brain chemistry ping in a way that makes working here more palatable.
Yeah.
And I've heard it just often enough in the context of big companies, sort of tech bro, whatever stuff, like, gamification of society will make doing shitty stuff less shitty and
get us all addicted to shitty things. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, there are better ways to make shitty things less shitty, starting with, you know, paying people better. But the whole term has been somewhat tainted in that way.
Yeah, that makes sense. So most lyric games are written in the form of a instruction manual, basically. But they're also not necessarily meant to be played, as we've already discussed. They're sort of meant to be read as experiences, which kind of puts them more in the genre of literature than game, even if they're sort of pretending to be games. Again, I love all these things. Who cares what they actually are? But you follow the thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But some lyric games really are pushing back against even that. People are publishing them as games on itch, but you open up like I Eat Mantras for Breakfast, and it's like a bunch of album covers with beat poetry that is not instructional in any way that's yelling at you. And these lyric games, they're clearly lyric games in the sense that they are coming out of the same movement, the same community, the same people and philosophies, but they're also completely losing the pretense that what you are doing is engaging with a game. Except also they're sort of still calling themselves games. And so I don't know. I just think that there's something really interesting in breaking the form of a game that far.
Yeah.
To take something that really is just like, yeah, fuck bitch, the one you send out into outer space, the one that ripples to every reality and lifetime, the one that touches the very fabric of aspected multidimensional hoopla, the one that recognizes your DNA and nabbing fate's thread by the neck. Define LOL, bitch, when? Okay, so that's one of the pages from this game. Like, that's kind of interesting. Like, it's the layout is interesting. Like, it's a great piece of art still, even if this kind of art is not exactly to my style. But it is, it's still calling itself a game. And that's so, like, that's so, wow, what do you do with that?
Yeah, I mean, it is like instructive, not in the sense that it's like, oh, you need to read these words and do these things.
Yeah.
But it is sort of a, like, there's kind of an unwritten instruction of, hey, feel this. Like, take a second and feel this. Connect with me about what I'm writing. Think about it for a bit. And in some way, that's kind of like, you know, the unwritten instruction in all of art.
Yeah.
But I think framing it as like, hey, here's a lyric game is maybe making that a bit more, not explicit, just intended and recognizable, I think.
Yeah.
And also, to be fair, on the very first page of this, I Eat Mattress for Breakfast, it does note, fucking bullshit by yours truly, Maria Mason.
It's not a game, it's a bullshit.
Yeah, if you don't like it, you do not need to like it. Congratulations, there you go. But I also read this because, again, like you said, it's not necessarily my particular style of art that I would normally engage with. but it was still interesting. And I do feel like there's a specific cadence to it in terms of here's a bright, colorful page with affirmations and like one of those like, yes, hi, I like my body. I'm so fucking carnal and here and it's so damn nice that my body continues to breathe even when I sometimes don't want to anymore. And it's very up and positive. And then the pages that have sort of instructions on them are just white text on a black background. And it feels like deliberately evoking like a bipolar sort of manic depressive, like, hey, when you're up, this is how up you are. This is how it feels. And when you're down, here's some small instructions to maybe make it a little less difficult to be down.
Yeah.
And like, I don't know if that's at all deliberate. The artist's page at the end just says, hi, I'm Maria. I like yelling recently. And I think games and its weird intersection of artistic experiential creation collaboration is rad AF. And that's like that, that's really what it's about. If you're looking for sort of a statement on, hey, here's what this is. It is a game and the intersection of games and artistic experiential creation, collaboration, compassion. And this is, I don't know, it's
rad AF. I don't know,
it's fundamentally someone wanted to make a thing and they made a thing. And
I love anything that knows exactly what it is and leans so hard into being exactly that thing. And none of these lyric games know what they are better than I Eat Mantras for Breakfast.
Yeah, I agree. That's it leans all the way in. And like we kind of prefaced, it's not 100% our jam, but I think there's still obviously value from checking it out and engaging with it as a, hey, take a second and see what this makes you think, see what it makes you feel. And that really is like more art than game, but also a game in what we've kind of covered is, hey, here's this piece of media that is going to be at least a little bit instructional in how you engage with it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what this is. There we go.
All right. I have a couple of sort of quick hit questions for us to wrap up on.
I'm ready.
So I'm just looking at my notes. These aren't questions, the first couple. I have here, games can be shitposts and shitposts can be beautiful, which I think is a really great mantra for my opinion of lyric games.
Yeah, and like it's a chance for anyone to really experience a little bit of that like slightly unhinged joy of creation.
Yeah.
Where you're going to make a thing. It doesn't need to be perfect, but you can do it. And I think one of the really nice things about Itch as a platform is it lets you put things out there really easily.
You can release some art like this and, you know, be a, like a digital busker, as you have described it in the past.
Yeah. Because that's really like, considering that so many of these are like free or a dollar or have 500 community copies available, like it really is like, hey, if you like what I did, give me a dollar. If you don't, well, maybe I'll get you next time. Have a good day.
Yeah. Oh, this is a bigger question, but why do you think we care so much about taxonomies? Like, why are we so excited to spend a bunch of time talking about what is a game and are lyric games games, or are they literature, or are they poetry, or what are they? Why do we care?
I think that the key thing is that these categorizations and taxonomies do have sort of a moral weight that we assign to them in terms of like art. Like if you describe something as art, that carries some like inherent, like this is worth discussing and worth thinking about and worth talking about. And so when you describe something as not art, you cleave all of that off. And it's very belittling essentially toward something someone created. And I think like people can create stuff that is or isn't art all the time. I think it's anytime you're looking at something that someone has created and put out to say, hey, I am expressing myself a little bit with this. This is a little bit a reflection of me. I think it's you want to engage in that with good faith and also perhaps a little like charitably.
Yeah.
You know, if someone puts something out and it's not something that is to your taste, it's not something that you would engage with and spend a bunch of your time with, the worst thing you should do, not the worst thing you could do, there are way worse things you could do, but as bad as you should be about it, is just move on. Just be like, nope, not for me, walking away, because that's fine and acceptable. Anything more than that is maybe like actively a little shitty, but
yeah. Do you think self-expression is inherently valuable?
Yeah, like, yes. Categorically, yes. Like, before I get into any nuances, got to get that out there.
Yeah.
I do think that self-expression is valuable. If you're not someone who creates things and puts them out there for an audience, it might be valuable to you on a personal level. Like, hey, I'm going to learn where some of my comfort zones are or why some of this might be exciting or scary for the people who do this on a very regular basis. It might be a chance to experiences that I have that are like, that I want to keep to myself. Like choosing what you don't sort of express can be just as important and meaningful. And I think that, so obviously there are people who have like shitty, negative, hurtful opinions. And I think that those people can express those opinions and then promptly get yelled at and shut down. I think that is kind of the value in those opinions sort of being expressed, is if someone says something shitty, that's bad. But then it becomes up to the people around them to say, hey, like, don't be that guy.
Yeah, some people are expressing opinions that are trying to shut down the self-expression of other people, especially.
Yes,
like,
yeah.
I think self-expression is inherently valuable. And a more interesting question is, like, who is it inherently valuable to? Because I think being understood is an incredibly important quality of being human. I think it is really, really important. Or even if it's not important, like, I personally have such a strong desire to be understood by other people that expressing myself, trying to communicate my experience of the world to someone else and succeeding, hopefully, is really, really valuable because it brings us closer together. Like, it gives both of us a wider understanding of the world. And, and that, you know, creates empathy and hopefully goodness in the world.
Yeah.
And, like, every form of self-expression is not 100% valuable for that reason. Mm-hmm. As you're saying, some self-expression is harmful or trying to shut down other people's self-expression or complicated or messy or something that you fail at. But I do think the act of trying to express yourself is important.
Yeah, I mean, that's really true. And then a lot of the things that people create in, like a lyric game or a very independent space is... it's like a little bit of like a sort of trust fall in the sense of like, hey, I'm putting this out. It might be intensely personal. It might be a little more shitposty, but I am sort of trusting the community and the people around me to pick it up and engage with it with at least the same level of sincerity with which it's presented.
Yeah. In good faith.
Yeah. Yeah. And like in good faith can mean very different things for different kinds of creations. Like, we are but worms. Like, the way to engage with that in good faith is to writhe and to tell the people around you to writhe. And yeah, that's a little goofy. That's shitposty. It's kind of dumb, but it is the way to engage with that work in good faith. And that's very different from my brain is a stick of butter, where the way to engage with that in good faith is to come at it with the sort of anticipation that you're going to learn a bit about a person's very personal struggles.
Yeah.
And to kind of create empathy there and carry that with you. And so I think that like the lyric game movement is very much built on this sort of good faith engagement with things. And I think that's worth carrying toward not just other media, but other people you see and interact with in the world.
I want to return slightly to the topic about why do we care so much about taxonomies and categories?
Yeah.
Because I think it's a really similar conversation to why do dudes like us, at least, really enjoy ranking things. Why is ranking things so popular? So first, there's the problems with ranking games, right? Putting things in a hierarchy is not useful. Like, it's it's like a form of violence, if you want to be really dramatic about it, right? Like, saying one person's self-expression is better than another person's self-expression is not something I love, because you can't directly compare the two. Like, one might be more successful in a lot of ways than the other. I've certainly read some screenplays that are not effective for this reader in my lifetime. You know what I mean? But it is also the case that everything is trying to accomplish something different. Everything is trying to do something different, and to hold them all to the same standard is kind of silly and put things in a hierarchy that way. But on the other hand, ranking things and the structure, the game of ranking things is so useful for comparing and contrasting and just talking about the things that you're ranking. Like talking about what are your top five favorite action movies lets you have a framework by which to compare or to start a conversation about the differences between action movies and what you like and what you don't and what other people like and don't, and just how you're going to communicate with each other about the art in question. And I think the conversation around categories and taxonomies is really similar, where there is this element of violence, again, to be dramatic, that you really, I think, described well of putting things into buckets often means that we're saying this bucket good, that bucket bad, that bucket is a waste of my time. Lyric games are something we can look down on, and that's bad. But on the other hand, I really like the ability to talk about what is a game, and if these are games, what does that mean about games at large? And if these aren't games, what does that mean about these things and games at large and everything else? And and any conversation about hierarchy and category has the potential to do harm and has the potential to be a baseline for having conversations you couldn't otherwise have.
Yeah, I think it's very true, because just about every discussion of, hey, we're going to rank like top five board games or whatever.
Yeah.
It very quickly devolves into a sort of like, well, top five by what measure? Top five for who?
Yeah.
I'm sure that if you were to rank, okay, what are my top five action movies? That list is going to be subtly different than what do I consider the top five most essential action movies? Like, like if you're someone who's never seen an action movie in your life, what five do you need to go for? Like, it's an interesting and kind of thorny issue, specifically because you said creating a hierarchy of other people's self-expression is hard. It becomes a little bit softer with something like a movie where, you know, there's a huge, massive crew that worked on it under a specific set of constraints. And it's easier to say, oh, well, like this movie was really good, but I think that they just didn't have the budget for what they were trying to achieve in certain ways. Or this movie was like hampered by some really unfortunate CGI choices or dated language that I wouldn't recommend it anymore. And like things like that. Whereas something as like intense, like a top 10 best poems list, impossible. Which again, as soon as we say, oh, this is some way in which something is impossible, people are going to gleefully prove that wrong.
Yeah.
I think that's great. But I'm not really interested in a poems list beyond here are 10 poems I like.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the value that I want and that I would get out of it.
Yeah. So there are any other like examples you wanted to make sure we hit here?
Yeah, one more that I had was actually another one from Riverhouse Games called The Treasure at the End of This Dungeon is an Escape from This Dungeon and We Will Never Escape from This Dungeon. And this one is kind of like a deconstruction of kind of the dungeon crawler as an experience. It splits the difference between kind of a, you know, more traditional game and a lyric game. In that there are still character classes and playbooks, and you could sit down and run this game as a one shot or potentially an infinity shot, because you will, as the title says, you will never escape from this dungeon. But it is just kind of a interesting meditation breakdown of like what makes a dungeon crawler tick in certain ways.
Interesting.
That there are a series of rooms that are the puzzle, the trick room, the battle, and the treasure at the end of this dungeon. And each room you engage with has certain rules for when you enter the room, do some stuff, and then answer some questions. And a bit that I wanted to hit is like slight spoilers, but when you make it to the room that is the treasure at the end of this dungeon, one of the questions is, what made you think you could escape from this dungeon? And what do you feel when you realize you're back at the start of this dungeon? Like, there are certain properties that I think people talk about, like, oh, this would make a great RPG. And people are really passionate about Dark Souls, but I don't think Dark Souls is one of them normally, specifically because the game has such a focus on dying and retrying. And I guess sort of you eventually overcome the challenges in that game.
This is not that game. This is a game where you have a character and then they will die and then another character will show up and you don't worry about it too much. It is just, that's how the dungeon works.
Yeah.
You're in it, you're not escaping, but every room and every class in here has some interesting stuff. I think the thief might be my favorite class, which I don't even know how much I want to spoil out of it.
It reminds me of another kind of lyrical dungeon crawler called Dot Dungeon, which is very much a game that is intended to be played. Mm-hmm. It is very much not in the spirit of Lyric games in that regard, but it is like an OSRE kind of game, so you can play any module with it. But the character classes are like the bard, who gets mechanical benefits for curating the session playlist, and there's some class that gets mechanical benefits for making character art of everyone.
Oh, that's drawings. Cool.
And so it's this meditation on, like, the framing of it is that you are all your real life selves playing an MMO together. And the MMO is the, like, fiction RPG that you're playing. And all of these classes, some are very much in the world of the MMO and are more commentary on MMO. Like, one of the classes allows you to, like, be a hacker and, like, cheat at the game, essentially. And some of them are more a meditation on you as a player and what you are contributing to the game outside the traditional realm of contributions, like the bard and the artist I was describing. And that feels like it's sort of a quarter of the way to Lyric game experience. And maybe the You Will Never Escape from This Dungeon is like three quarters of the way.
Yeah.
And then something like I Eat Mantras for Breakfast is like at the 100 level.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Like I Eat Mantras for Breakfast is like, it's like at 150%. I want to say I'd be remiss if I didn't mention this one, because like I said, it is a very cool, very playable meta meditation on RPGs and dungeon crawl kind of vibes.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to ask you about one word RPGs as a medium, because I know you've written one. This is what the end of the world sounds like, also on Itch. So here's my question about one word RPGs. Do you think that word needs to be a verb?
I'm trying to write one right now. Like, I thought, like, what if the word is like goats? What does that do?
I've got it. Here's the one word RPG where the word is not a verb.
Yeah.
The word is mules, with credit to Ogden Nash.
Ogden Nash, famous weird little poet guy with the poem The World of Mules, which goes, in the world of mules, there are no rules.
Yeah, he's a very famous poet slash shit poster.
Much like a lot of these Lyric game authors.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you've ever seen like a photo of like a shit poster in black and white, you can Google Ogden Nash. If you've gotten to this point in the episode, I'm sure that Ogden Nash has something that you will enjoy.
All right. So, okay, I want to get to our couple of contributions to the Lyric game genre. So you mentioned that I wrote this game, This Is What the End of the World Sounds Like. I wrote this during the height of 2020 lockdown, and the word is listen, which I consider to probably be the best poem I've ever written and a game that I play far too often while falling asleep at night. But
I think it's fair. I mean, I've downloaded it and read it because that's what I do for most of the stuff you write, because we're friends and because I think you do good work. And that is another one where sometimes I'll be taking a walk, or I think the last time I played it, I was sitting in a clinic waiting room, which that was a place.
Yeah.
So
those beeping IVs, that is what the end of the world sounds like. Anyway, God, sometimes my own art astounds me at how good it is. You also have made what I consider to be revolutionary contribution to the Lyric game genre with a supplement for We Are But Worms.
Yeah, this is, like I said, my contribution to the world of Lyric games. And it is But No More, a one-letter supplement for We Are But Worms, a one-word RPG. My one-letter supplement is T.
Where do you put the T?
Oh, you put the T after but in We Are But Worms.
So it becomes We Are But Worms.
A one-word RPG. The rules of the game remain the same. I think it is transformative.
Yeah.
While still retaining kind of the elegance and replayability of the original.
Yeah. All right, is there anything else you wanted to tell me about here, David?
So I was thinking, like, the one thing that I would want to sign out of this episode with, if I could leave, like, one bit of energy, it is read more poetry and don't let anyone tell you what is or isn't poetry. So.
That's a great place to end.
Yeah.
All right, I have one last question for you.
Okay.
Which is, have you ever just sat down and played We Are But Worms?
I have not just sat down and played it. I have not sat and really properly writhed.
David, do you want to join me in Dice Exploder's first ever actual play?
Yeah. Do I need to mute my mic for this?
No. I think we'll keep the mics open.
Okay. I'm going to make sure I don't have any especially fragile objects. Or maybe I will. Maybe something will just break. Whatever.
Yeah. All right.
Oh, I think I'm going to get arms above head.
Yeah. Great. Here we go. You ready?
Oh, I'm doing it.
All right. Great. Here we go.
Oh, I feel like it's against the spirit of worms to think that something was good for your back and your bones and your spine. Anything but, you know, whatever worms use to move around and give their body structure. But it actually felt nice. That was
we are
good.
But worms. Number one, it's an exercise routine, people. That's what it is.
The health craze sweeping the nation.
That's right. Thanks so much again to David for coming on. You can't find him online because he is much smarter than most of us. But you can find But No More, a one-letter supplement for We Are But Worms, a one-word RPG, on Itch or in the show notes. And you can come talk with both of us about all things art and games in the Dice Exploder Discord. You can find me and all my games on Itch at S. Dunnewald or on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Dice.camp. Our logo was designed by Spore Gory, and our theme song is Sunset Bridge by Purely Gray. And thanks, as always, to you for listening. See you next time.